This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, hoping you'll bear with me as I hack my way through my last days of laryngitis, so please bear with those squeaks. I have nothing to do with them. From tsunamis to nuclear meltdowns to floods and wildfires, you know, sometimes it seems like we're moving from one disaster to the next. Is this true? Are there more disasters now, or are we just more aware of them? My next guest says maybe it's a bit of both. In an article for Slate magazine, Joel Achenbach writes that the 21st century will be known as the century of natural disasters and technological crises and unholy combinations of the two. But he's here to tell us why we shouldn't worry and at the same time how to prepare. Joel Achenbach is a reporter and science writer for The Washington Post. His latest book is A Hole at the Bottom of the Sea, The Race to Kill the BP Oil Gusher. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Ira, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be on this great show you have, so thank you.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to have you on to talk about it, because I know you've written many, many books, seven books, and you've written a lot about disasters, oil spills. You've been a reporter for the Post for 21 years. Does it seem to you like it does to us that we're seeing more disasters now than ever?
Lately, it seems like that's all I cover are disasters. You know, it's the Mississippi River flood, the Japan tragedy, the Fukushima meltdown after that. I'm really glad that solar flare this week didn't hit us directly because, you know, here in Washington, it's about 98 degrees. It's been this way all week, and I would not have wanted a solar flare disaster to knock out the transformers on the grid. I know you have guests going to talk about that, but that is one of the sort of potential calamities that could happen out there when you have, I mean, essentially what we have here is a planet with 7 billion people living in many cases in large cities that are in seismically hazardous places or are vulnerable to tsunamis. There's a lot of people and a lot of stuff vulnerable to these ancient forces. Plus, we have all of our systems, our grids, our nuclear power plants. Or last year, we saw what happened with the deep water drilling. That's what my book was about, is the BP disaster. So the technology creates these systems that are vulnerable to catastrophic failure.
So we have the systems and technology in place that we never had 25 or 30 years ago. And we have more people living near those things than we didn't have before.
If you go back to 1800, the year 1800, there was one city in the world that had a million people, and that was Beijing. The most recent count I've come across is that there are 381 cities with at least a million people. Of those cities, a lot of them are in seismically very hazardous places like Caracas, Venezuela, or Mexico City, or Kathmandu. And if you're living in a city and you are poor, you're not going to worry about events that don't happen but once every 200 years or so. But this is the future. This is going to happen because a lot of these people live in homes that are not well built. If you look what happened in Haiti last year, I mean, yes, an earthquake caused the disaster, but what really killed people were buildings, the lack of rebar, the fact that they were living in unreinforced structures. And so a lot of people around the world are in those kind of conditions and are sort of sitting ducks because of the seismic hazard. There was a study by, I think it was Roger Billum at the University of Colorado, that said that 403 million people on the planet today live in places with significant seismic hazard.
You say these things are black swan events. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's a term that was popularized a few years ago by Nassim Taleb in a book he wrote called The Black Swan, in which he talked about these events sort of out of the blue that are game changers. And people have said that 9/11 was a black swan, or that the housing collapse and the financial crisis of 2008 was a black swan. Inevitably, these events actually have precursors. I mean, they are predictable at some level. I mean, 9/11 didn't really come out of the blue. It just seemed that way. If you're in government or in a policy position, you have to figure out how do we prepare for events that are low probability but high consequence. So, for example, last year, the Deepwater Horizon blowout, it was a black swan event. No one saw that coming. It when it happened, I can testify as a newspaper reporter, we didn't understand what we were looking at. We didn't realize that this was a blowout, and this fire on the rig that killed 11 people was going to begin this 3 or 4 or 5 month disaster that we were going to be covering every day on the front page. We just didn't know what we were looking at because it was so unfamiliar to us. And I think that's one thing that if you're, in a policy position, if you're the head of FEMA or the president of the United States, you need to be aware that you don't get to pick your next disaster. You don't get to decide, what is going to be the big issue in July, looking at it from the perspective of early June, because you just don't know. And so the answer is, how do you become resilient, adaptable, flexible, and able to respond quickly and with some grace when things go bad?
On the other hand, we're seeing hurricanes of unprecedented strength. We're seeing floods of that are huge, that they haven't seen in the history of the Mississippi. We're seeing tornadoes that are a mile wide. I mean, it's hard to say that, we have not entered an era of bigger, greater, giant disasters.
Well, climate change is arguably a huge disaster in and of itself. It hasn't played out, to the extent that it will. I mean, it is a fact we're in a warming planet. And all the models would predict that as climate change, as the planet warms, you're going to have more moisture in the atmosphere. You're going to have larger flooding events, more intense droughts. I don't know that you could say that the flood in the Mississippi this year is because of climate change. I know that it annoys people, but I stick to the formulation that you can't attribute a single event to climate change, but it is reasonable to say that we're loading the dice, that we're setting ourselves up for trouble, and that over time, rapid climate change, if it happens quickly and severely, could outpace our ability to adapt to it, and we don't really know how it will play out entirely. It creates a lot of uncertainty, and so I think that at the very least, the people who run this country and who make decisions around the world need to, face the facts about climate change, that this is real. It's not a hoax. This is not something, it didn't stop in 1998. Global warming didn't stop in 1998. And the carbon dioxide is steadily going up in the atmosphere, and there's going to be consequences of that.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Okay, now that we have alarmed everybody.
Exactly. Have a nice day.
Well, but you stay, and you say, don't worry. I mean, we've talked about all the reasons why we should worry.
Well, what I would say, first of all, is, I worry, am I going to be able to pay for college tuition? I worry, are my tomatoes going to actually bear fruit this summer in my backyard? I don't walk around worrying that the sky is going to fall. I do think that people ought to be aware that the grid could go out for a week or two or longer. In fact, getting back to the solar flares, I mean, one of the concerns is you could lose the grid for many months. You could have if a flare were to take out the transformers, and there's been some research on that recently. I think people need to understand that not every day is going to go as planned, and the technology doesn't always work. I mean, one thing that jumped out at me from doing my book was that here you had this the offshore oil drilling industry. Lots of very brilliant engineering goes into drilling holes in mile deep water. It's amazing that they can do it. I mean, these rigs are ships that are dynamically positioned and able to reach these reservoirs that are not only below a mile of water, but then they're another 2.5 miles down below in the formation. And this technology is stunning to behold, but it's not necessarily quite as robust as the engineers would hope. We saw that when the blowout preventer was unable to seal the well, and what we have is an engineered planet now. we have increasingly put ourselves in the grip of these complex systems that can fail in complex ways. You look what happened in Fukushima. There you got these six nuclear reactors. All six had problems, not just because there was a big earthquake and then a tsunami. The problem was they lost electricity. Never mind how it happened. They lost electricity, and those systems were not designed to cool the nuclear fuel rods and so on if they lost electricity. So I would say that people need to be aware that complex systems don't always work as planned. And so if I can just ramble here for another second, let's talk about climate change and geoengineering. Are you sure you want to do that? Are you sure you want to invest a lot of technology in trying to cool the planet artificially? Will that system work as planned?
So be careful before you get what you're asking for, is what you're saying.
Yeah, be careful what you ask for. I guess I don't mean to scare people. I mean, I just think that one thing that people need to do is listen to Science Friday, okay? read a book occasionally about science and technology. Figure out how the systems around you work. You know, where does electricity come from? What is electricity? You know, where does your water come from? Have some sense that, you know, that we live embedded in this engineered
civilization. And be ready for a disaster when it strikes.
Well, just, you know, buy some batteries, not only for yourself, but for your neighbor who's not going to remember to buy batteries, who's going to come asking to borrow some.
I've seen that Twilight Zone episode. Yeah. Well, thank you, Joel, for taking time to be with us and being there.
I hope people enjoyed it.
Well, I think you got to be scared. It's a good motivating factor.
Not scared, just focused. Just aware.
Okay. We'll take that thought with us, Joel. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
All right. Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Joel Achenbach is a reporter and science writer for The Washington Post. His latest book is A Hole at the Bottom of the Sea, The Race to Kill the BP Oil Gusher. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about new infrastructure and talk about that grid. That grid that Joel mentioned, what happened with the solar flare? Did it affect the grid? It actually did. And the grid survived. We'll talk about it when we get back. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Those heavy boxes of emails may have reporters in a be careful what you wish for state of mind. NPR's David Folkenflik says many leading news organizations are eager for help going through them from you.
That's a lot of emails to wade through. Jim Roberts is assistant managing editor for news at the New York Times, and he says, bear with us, folks.
I can't begin to imagine how difficult it will be, and it's very possible that we will report things this afternoon that are potentially less important than things we will find tomorrow.
The Times has three reporters in Juneau who are poring through the records, and the documents are being posted as quickly as possible. But it's also asking readers to send tips pointing to noteworthy emails. The Washington Post and a consortium of the liberal magazine Mother Jones, MSNBC.com, and ProPublica have launched similar initiatives.
There's been a certain amount of criticism that we and other news organizations have heard about, you know, is this a smear Sarah effort? We're just looking to see whether the simple fact of having more eyeballs on these documents will help us learn things about them.
But that's not forestalling the criticism. Fox News host Greta Van Susteren, whose husband has been a Palin advisor, asked readers of her blog whether major news outlets were performing a public service or a colonoscopy. And here's a few choice comments from the Times' readers on its article appealing for help, as read by the NPR players.
I don't remember the New York Times asking the public to go through then-Senator Obama's emails to find newsworthy materials.
Don't you folks get paid to do this work yourself?
Why didn't you invite people to help read the health care bill before it took effect, so we could know what was in it?
Actually, congressional records, such as Barack Obama's Senate emails, are not subject to Freedom of Information requests. In Palin's case, it is a fishing expedition, but it's also an irresistible lure. She inspires strong reaction, good or bad. She's weighing a run for president. She was embroiled in controversy while governor, and she hails from a state with sturdy public records laws. David Korn of Mother Jones was the first to file a comprehensive request for her records.
So what we have here is, like during the gold rush days, 16 or so news organizations all running to the same creek, panning furiously.
Crowdsourcing efforts to scrutinize records aren't all that new. Readers of the British newspaper The Guardian helped the paper find financial abuses by members of parliament there. But such successes are rare, and the technique itself is infrequently attempted. Jay Rosen is a New York University journalism professor. Rosen has encouraged news organizations to incorporate the expertise of their audience, but he gives the media mixed marks.
Part of the reason for that is we don't really have a close collaboration between investigative reporters who really know how to work with documents and users who could help with some of the labor. And we don't have a lot of imaginative ideas for it either.
Sarah Palin says the press is just seeking messages to pull out of context. But editors at The Times say it's nothing of the sort. They say if this experiment works, they'll try it more often in the future on candidates from both parties. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. Journalist Scott Carney has done the math and figures he's worth about $250,000. That figure's not based on Carney's savings or his assets. Instead, that $250,000 is what Carney figures his body would fetch if it were broken down into individual parts and sold on what he calls the red market. And that's the title of his new book, in which he explores the shadowy and lucrative global marketplace for organs, bones, and blood. Scott Carney joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And Scott, you call this marketplace the Flesh Bazaar. How big an industry has this become?
Well, it's really hard to get accurate figures on what the illegal market is on body parts. But I'm figuring it's definitely in the billions of dollars that are moving hands as we look at all the industries that buy and sell bodies, everything from blood to kidneys to hair to corneas. I mean, it's a really large business that not many people know about.
I want to ask you about one of the places that you visit for your book. It's a refugee camp in India set up for survivors of the massive 2004 tsunami. And so many women there, you say, have sold one of their kidneys that the camp has become known as Kidneyville.
Right, or Kidneyvakam in Tamil. Yeah, it was really surprising to me to go to this village where there are probably 800 or 1,000 people living there. And when just women just lined up, and you could see in their saris, they have their exposed midriffs, and there are all these kidney extraction scars. Because when the tsunami happened, these organ brokers came in and realized that there were a lot of people in very desperate situations, and they could turn a lot of quick cash by just convincing these people to sell their kidneys.
These women, of course, are paid much more, I imagine, than they could make otherwise. Is there anything illegal about what's going on there?
Oh, it's completely against the law to buy and sell a kidney in almost every country in the world. The standard that we are supposed to use is donation and altruism. We're supposed to give this, not make it a market for flesh. We're supposed to do it where you just do it because of this feeling of goodwill. But that's not what actually happens in a lot of the world. The market drives it, and the body quickly gets reduced to a commodity.
What did these women in Kidneyville tell you about why they decided to give up one of their kidneys and what happened when they went through that procedure?
Well, they all gave up because for money. I mean, there was a straight commercial transaction for them. And it's usually because they were in a very, very desperate situation. One of these women, her name was Rani, gave up a kidney because her daughter had actually tried to commit suicide because she was in a very difficult marriage. She consumed some sort of pesticide and was taken to the hospital. And in order to treat her, the hospital needed a certain amount of cash. It was, I think it was about $1,000. And she didn't have any money, and so she did the only thing she could, which was sell her kidney because an organ broker just approached her very quickly. And that's a pretty common situation. You know, when you're at your most desperate place is when the brokers come in.
Part of what you say is ethically troublesome about these transactions is that the red market, as you call it, is moving flesh upward but never downward through social classes.
Right. And this is one of the very foundational concepts of the book, is that when people say give an organ or when someone sells one of their eggs, it's never going to somebody sort of a similar economic background. It's always going to a richer person, and oftentimes it's going to a person in another country. It gets reduced to this commerce so quickly and so easily. And the benefits never really come back. I mean, when you're selling a piece of your tissue, all the studies that have been conducted on this over the last 20 years say that there's no real long-lasting economic benefit to these people who give up their flesh.
And you say that if you had your way, every bag of blood would be tagged with the donor's name, same with every organ for transplant, every egg donation. The counterargument to that, though, would be that the anonymity protects the donor. If you do away with privacy, you're going to see donations plummet, and health will suffer.
You will see donations plummet. I mean, I think one great example of that is what happened in the United Kingdom, where they saw all sorts of violations going on with IVF and with egg donation coercion because of payments to donors and things, that they opened up the records. Now, anyone can track a record for an egg donor in the UK. And you did see donation levels plummet. And I think that is, in some ways, quite bad. But on the other hand, if you were allowing crimes of the magnitude of people, literally whole villages selling their kidneys, who are we protecting? Are we protecting the recipient and the rights of the consumer of this organs? Or are we protecting the supply chain and the very beginning of it? And my argument is the book, we have to look at the beginning of the supply chain. We have to be sure that we're getting these things ethically and not just assume that we're being ethical.
Scott, I want to end by asking you about another fascinating and lucrative human commodity that's not a grisly one. It's something called black gold. What's black gold?
Black gold is human hair, and it is amazingly valuable. The market is about $900 million around the world, and about 40% of the hair that's sold for human extensions and that sort of thing comes from a temple in South India called the Venkateshwara Temple at Tirupati. And what this is people give their hair to the god Venkateshwara as an act of humility, or occasionally if a family member dies, you'll give sort of a boon to this god. And so I went there about 2 years ago and had my head shaved with, you know, probably about 1,000 other people. And these women came and swept up the hair and threw it into these giant steel vats that, you know, eventually filled up in the course of a day or two. The vats were maybe 10 feet tall, and they just, you know, filled of human hair. And this eventually gets combed and sorted and sold at an auction and shipped out to the international market.
Where would it end up?
Well, it goes all over the world. There's two different types. There's Remy, which is a hair which is collected in a single cut and is from one single person's head. And there's non-Remy, which is just sort of a sorted hair. Most of it gets sent to the United States and Europe, often to black beauty parlors, but it's also, you know, widely popular in Africa and Asia and really all over the world.
So you lined up and got your head shaved too.
I did. I was bald as a cue ball at the end of it.
And who knows where your hair ended up?
Well, that's interesting. I have a guess. If the hair's not long enough for an extension, I have pretty short hair, and most of the hair that gets shorn is from men. That gets sold to chemical companies and reduced to an amino acid called L-cysteine, which is used as a leavening agent in baking goods. So maybe it's in a donut that you're eating. I don't know.
I will not think of baked goods quite the same way.
No, I don't think I will either.
Scott Carney. His book is The Red Market, On the Trail of the World's Organ Brokers, Bone Thieves, Blood Farmers, and Child Traffickers. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Melissa. I appreciate it.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It was another bad day for the stock market. The Dow lost 172 points today. It finished below 12,000 for the first time since March. And that loss continues a downward trend. This is the sixth week in a row that the Dow has finished the week lower than it began. You'd have to go back to 2002 to find a longer string of consecutive weekly declines. NPR's Jim Zaroli joins us to talk about this. Jim, how bad is it?
Well, I mean, we've certainly seen a lot worse days than this, but it was pretty ugly. A lot of stocks fell. Energy stocks were down because oil prices fell. A lot of bank stocks fell. Travelers, the big insurance company, which is part of the Dow, came out and said there have been so many natural disasters, it won't make as much money as it expected. So it fell. A lot of other companies fell. It wasn't a bloodbath. It was just a continuation of this long erosion of value that we've been seeing for about 6 weeks. And as a result, we're back to where we were in January for both the S&P 500 and the Dow.
And Jim, what's behind that erosion you're talking about? What's causing so many investors to run for cover?
Well, I think, you know, it's really just that we've had dribs and drabs of bad news for 6 weeks or so, really. Just look at some of the economic news that has come out lately. Housing prices have fallen more. They have been a huge drag on economic growth. Industrial output is down. And then there's unemployment. The job market has been, you know, growing for a while, but the growth has never been what you would call strong. And last month, job creation wasn't even really enough to keep pace with the growth in population. Then this week, the Fed came out and said it wasn't going to do anything new to stimulate the economy. So, you know, a lot of investors are just looking at this and questioning whether this is a market that they want to be in.
And do you think what's happening with the market is really a signal of what's to come?
Well, I think that's what a lot of investors are worried about. I think until earlier this year, you know, a lot of investors were thinking, growth is slow, but the trajectory is higher. And if you park your money in stocks, you do pretty well. Clearly, they're reassessing that now. You know, of course, the stock market has always had a way of anticipating downturns that don't quite happen. And it may be that just within a few months, this will all be, you know, a distant memory. A lot of big U.S. companies are still in very good shape. They have a lot of cash on their balance sheets. They're making money. But I think on the whole, a lot of investors are just looking at, you know, everything that's happened, everything that's come out lately. And they're just, you know, having second thoughts about how good an investment stocks are right now.
And Jim, if people are not parking their money in stocks, as you say, where are they parking it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you could invest overseas, you know, but Europe has troubles of its own with the debt crisis. There's evidence that Asian markets are slowing a bit. Countries like China are having big concerns about inflation. So they've been putting the brakes on growth, which means China is no longer the growth engine it was, although it's still growing at a rate that, you know, we can only envy. One place people are putting their money continues to be U.S. government debt. It's a safe haven in difficult times. We hear a lot, you know, we hear so much now about how much the U.S. borrows. There's controversy over the debt ceiling. But at least for now, investors are willing to lend the United States money, and interest rates are a little lower today than they were.
Okay, NPR business correspondent Jim Zaroli. Jim, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered. And Anthony Weiner is one of many politicians providing fodder today for our regular political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back to you both.
Good to be with you.
And first off, let's go back to Monday and take a listen to Congressman Weiner speaking when he finally came out and confessed interminably. Here he is.
I regret not being honest about this. This was a big mistake So I was embarrassed. I was humiliated. I'm still to this moment. I was trying to protect my wife. I was trying to protect myself from shame. It was a mistake. And I really regret it.
David Brooks, somehow you have gone from Anthony Weiner's confession and connected that with your favorite philosopher, Edmund Burke of the 18th century. Explain.
No, to me, everything goes back to Burke.
Pretty much.
You know, I'm amazed he was capable of embarrassment. Well, Burke was a legislator. I'll tie it in that way. Burke was a legislator. Weiner was not a legislator. He got elected to Congress as a media star. He was not very good in Congress. He didn't really have friends. He didn't work on legislation. All he did was he went on TV and the radio. And so I think his effectiveness as a media star is pretty much over, and so his effectiveness in Congress is pretty much over.
You're already speaking about him in the past tense. E.J. Dionne, is his resignation, do you think, a foregone conclusion? Can he survive this if he survives redistricting?
Well, I'm not sure he can survive redistricting. And look, the voters in a district being loyal to you is understandable to me. I come from Massachusetts where we've reelected people from jail. And I don't think voters in a district ever like it when Washington tells them we got to overturn your last election. But when he gets back here next week, there are just so many Democrats who want him gone. They don't want to have to explain this. And many of them defended him when he denied that he had done this because they believed him. You shouldn't burn your colleagues like that. But the whole thing, when you think of the flow of news we've had, John Ensign and the John Edwards troubles, and now this, and we're treating presidential candidates, celebrities who aren't running as presidential candidates. I've been starting to think that Britney Spears' song, Keep On, you know, that refrain, Keep On Dancing Till the World Ends, will provide the soundtrack for some future documentary on our national decline. So it's from Burke to Britney Spears making the same point.
We're slipping downhill really fast. is this David Brooks a huge distraction for Democrats from issues they would rather be talking about, though?
Well, if they were accomplishing anything, one of the substantive things that's not happening is we're supposed to be negotiating a budget, a debt ceiling limit. And the negotiations run by Vice President Biden are going very slowly. And I'm not a market analyst, but I think the political risks are much higher than anybody on Wall Street anticipates. And there is a significant possibility that in the next 3 months we will have a pseudo-government shutdown with tremendously negative market effects.
Let's move on for a bit and talk about the Republican presidential hopefuls. This has been a lousy week for Newt Gingrich. His top advisors and staffers in the key early primary and caucus states quit yesterday en masse. EJ, what happened with the Newt Gingrich campaign and what will happen going forward, do you think?
What happened is what a lot of people expected to happen, which is Newt can be very interesting, but he does not have a whole lot of discipline. He believed that you could sell a campaign the way you sell books. You do a lot of social media, you go on radio. His campaign believed, and I think all these folks who quit are right, that you actually need to go out, organize voters, talk to people that way. I also love the line from Dave Carney, one of the advisors who quit, to Dan Baltz of the Post. He said, "We were living a Cadillac campaign on a Bud Light budget." Newt was used to living large when he was doing all his other stuff. But I think it may have been the 2 weeks off in Greece that really was the ship that launched 16 resignations. I mean, it was just, I think the campaign folks said, this ain't going to work.
Something tone deaf about cruising in the Greek Isles. David Brooks, does Newt Gingrich stay in the race? Do you think he says he is?
Yeah, I don't think so. We've had sort of a tutorial lesson in narcissism this week on many fronts. for Gingrich, well, the words that come out of his mouth one moment have nothing to do with what's coming out for the next 10 minutes. So there's no constancy to the guy. I think I said on the show a couple weeks ago the guy couldn't manage a 7-Eleven. I don't think he could manage an ATM machine. And so that was always going to be a problem. I never really took him that seriously. But the level of political celebrity, we now have these people who are sort of famous for being famous, and they're not sort of game show guests anymore. Now they're running for president, and he is one of them.
I think it's James Carville's line that when you're a celebrity, that's what you do for a living. But that's not what a politician or somebody elected to run our country is doing for a living.
Well, let's talk about the presumed Republican frontrunner for a bit. Mitt Romney announced he will skip straw polls in Florida, Michigan, and most significantly, the Iowa straw poll in August. EJ, this is not sitting well with Iowans. Does it hurt Mitt Romney overall, do you think, or is it a smart move?
Well, I kind of think that the thing Mitt Romney would love is for Michelle Bachmann to win the Iowa caucuses, because that would set him up as the establishment guy who can stop Michelle Bachmann. A lot of Republicans don't want to do that. I also think he is very well aware that Christian conservatives constitute a very substantial proportion of the caucus goers. That's one of the reasons Mike Huckabee beat him the last time. And they're very uncomfortable with the fact that Mitt Romney is a Mormon. He'll never say that. I don't think it's a good thing that there is prejudice against Mormons, but I think that's a fact that he's aware of.
Interesting to think about John Huntsman, too, the former Utah governor and ambassador to China, who has decided not to compete in the Iowa caucuses. For this reason, he said, "I don't believe in subsidies that prop up corn, soybeans, and ethanol." Now, this is a candidate who hasn't officially entered the race. David Brooks, he's also skipping next Monday's Republican candidates debate in New Hampshire. What's up with John Huntsman?
Yeah, he's abstemious. I don't think he's running because he's not going in Iowa because he's so too principled for Iowa. He, like Mitt Romney, doesn't have much of a shot there. And I think they're both right. As E.J. says, the idea for both of these two candidates is the Republican establishment gets completely panicked by a Bachman or Kane victory in Iowa, which is entirely plausible. They could even go 1-2. And then they...
That's Herman Cain, for those not following these things closely.
Godfather's pizza.
Yes. And then they sweep over to the establishment, and they're desperately searching for somebody who seems safe. The one thing to be said about Huntsman is a lot of people are now saying, oh, he's too moderate to be the candidate. It's important to remember that Rush Limbaugh is not the Republican primary voter. Rush Limbaugh campaigned against John McCain for 2 years. McCain still won the Republican primary in South Carolina and Florida. Rush Limbaugh and the radio talk jocks are now campaigning against Mitt Romney for saying global warming may be real, campaigning against John Huntsman. They do not deliver votes.
The Republican debate Monday night, I'm curious to hear from you both what you're going to be listening for from the Republican candidates. EJ first.
Well, I think we're going to sort of be curious about how they position themselves vis-a-vis Paul Ryan's budget. I mean, Tim Pawlenty came out with an economic speech where he almost made Paul Ryan look like a socialist, which is a remarkable thing to say. I mean, it struck me as a very irresponsible unrealistic view of how small you can cut government, how much you can cut taxes. But I think that is where the Republicans feel that their base is in terms of both taxes and the size of government. And I think there'll be almost a competition to pushing them in that direction in this debate.
David Brooks.
I wonder if they understand their base. Their base is the white working class. These people have seen their wages stagnate, their jobs decline, their social order fall apart. Do any of them have an actual agenda that plays to the white working class as opposed to cutting corporate tax rates? Huckabee last time actually did have an agenda, did have a feel for this population. So far, Pawlenty, who should have a feel, that's his background, gave this speech, which was really sort of a Wall Street Journal editorial page speech, not so much a white working class speech. So I'd like to see if any of them actually understand the people who are actually going to vote for them.
I like David's point. Trade unionist conservative point about the working class, and he's right about that.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Have a great weekend, guys.
Take care.
David Brooks of The New York Times and E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post. E.J., this one's for you. EJ's smiling. You're listening to All Things Considered.
J.J. Abrams is best known for creating or co-creating the TV series Felicity, Alias, and Lost, and for directing the 2009 movie remake of Star Trek. His new big-screen sci-fi thriller, Super 8, is co-produced by Steven Spielberg, who directed some of the films that most inspired Abrams. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
It would be easy to malign J.J. Abrams' Super 8 as a shameless ripoff of Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T., and Jurassic Park. That is, if Abrams didn't rekindle at least some of the excitement of seeing those films way back when. We didn't just consume Close Encounters and E.T. like so much disposable pop culture. We were dazzled by a new mode of storytelling, accessible to all, and yet personal and pure, the product of one visionary dreamer. But then came the Spielberg imitations, some produced by Spielberg's company, and his name became a dirty word. Oh no, not more lame Spielberg kiddie mush. Even Spielberg finally got the message and began to direct prestige movies. Now he has co-produced Super 8, and because 25 years have elapsed, we can savor it without having nightmarish flashbacks to the Goonies. And though Super 8 isn't in the same league as its models, it still hits home the way all the impersonal franchise pictures out there don't. It's called Super 8 because it's set in the 70s, pre-home video, and its adolescent characters are shooting a ragtag zombie flick at an isolated Ohio railroad station when the kid director spots a train heading their way and realizes he can exploit it by rushing the shot, a goodbye scene between a detective and his wife. Then young Joe Lamb, played by Joel Courtney, sees a pickup truck veering onto the tracks, heading straight for the onrushing train.
Positions! Positions!
Ready. Start filming. Be extra loud when the train passes by. Here we go. And action!
John, I don't like it. This case, these murders. What do you want me to do? Go to Michigan with you?
Mackinac Island's beautiful this time of year.
That crash is amazing. The explosions go on and on, and mammoth pieces of metal crash down at decibel levels no 80s movie could reach. The pickup truck driver, miraculously alive, tells the kids to run or be killed. The Air Force shows up, hunting what looks to be big and lethal, and might or might not involve nukes. People and pets disappear. And here I'll stop. Abrams has the storytelling savvy to keep you guessing from scene to scene, so it's criminal even to reveal the nature of the mystery. I can tell you the theme. Joe lost his mom in an industrial accident. His deputy father's a non-presence. And the girl he has a crush on, Alice, played by Elle Fanning, has a drunken single dad who had something to do with Joe's mother's death. So you have absent mothers and impotent or cruel fathers. And the Air Force officers turn out to be the cruelest patriarchal authorities of all. Joe and Alice and their pals race around doing what their parents won't or can't, solving the mystery and finally making contact with an entity that has its own authority issues. The kid's repartee isn't particularly witty, but Courtney is likably unaffected, and Fanning, young sister of Dakota, has that familiar, freaky, grown-up pale face and blue eyes. But Abrams misses a huge opportunity with the chubby director of the zombie movie. For easy laughs, the kid is inept in the Ed Wood mode. Whereas, if he had the talent of, say, a young Spielberg, we could have seen a connection between the emotional upheaval of childhood and a child's burgeoning filmmaking skills. At least J.J. Abrams makes you feel his enthusiasm. He was of the age to be influenced by Jaws and Close Encounters, and my guess is he's been fighting not to reproduce Spielberg's signature moves since he picked up a camera. Now, with the blessing of the master, he can plagiarize with alacrity. He can use sudden silence to make us laugh out loud at the prospect of being jolted out of our seats. He can film the starry heavens to make us instantly aware of all the mysteries of the universe we force ourselves to forget just to get on with our days. In Super 8, the magic of those older movies filters through like light from a distant star.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.